everyone is a star child, made of stardust and the infinite potential of the universe. This extraordinary, fearless something in each of us clamors for freedom from the bonds of fear, conformity, and an ordinary life. Welcome to Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where practical tools and solutions from the intersection of mind-body medicine, science, and spiritual well-being awaken and empower you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Hello, everyone, and welcome. I am your host, Dr. Balan A. Durr, and this is Dr. Durr's Living in the Sweet Spot, where we have conversations with my guest about the essential importance of brain health and transformative thinking as the doorway to the greatest demonstration of your infinite potential. Today, we're going to have part two of my conversation with Dr. Lynn Prashant. She has her doctorate in somatic thanatology. She's a bereavement specialist, an integrative grief therapist, and the founder of Degriefing Counseling and Education. Much of her work was inspired actually by the loss of her young husband and her sister. And she has done this work to honor them both. And I welcome back, Lynn.
Thank you so much. I'm really happy to be here. Truly. Good to see you again, Dr.
Yeah. And me as well. I was excited to have the conversation from the very beginning. And so again, now that we're getting an opportunity to continue it, because I think that this is really important work. This is, as you talk about, it's just, as you're trying to say, it's a part of life, just like traffic, right? How about if we remind people what the work it is that you do exactly, meaning, again, what is a thanatologist?
A thanatologist is a professional focus, studying and exploring the nature of death, dying, and bereavement.
Okay.
And along with that, yes, that is exactly the basis for that description, thanatologist.
Okay. So last time we got into a number of things, but we really didn't have a chance to dig deep on some things. So I wanted to, again, to continue that conversation. And, part of that we were talking about that I think is also important is, while they're the obvious losses that people grieve, they're also, what you call the non-death losses that people grieve. And such as like one of the things that I think is important is that, say, for instance, when a person decides to divorce, I think what people are really grieving is the loss of the fantasy, right? Not the marriage itself, because if the marriage was all of that, you wouldn't be getting divorced. So that's one instance. So why don't we begin about, just kind of reminding people, what your thoughts were, what your approach is, and then let's again go into talking about and describing what some of those non-death losses look like.
That's an a very important approach. Excuse me one moment. Life on a daily basis provides us with losses, loss of focus, loss of our timing, loss of our ability to get to a meeting exactly when we wanted to. The loss is a daily experience, and it's part of the human condition. Because everything in our world is impermanent, we experience the disconnect from things we love, things we're used to, the familiar. The body's response to any kind of loss is that of grief. So when we begin to understand that grief is part of the human experience, so sorry, pollen, loss of a clear throat right now. Yes, over here, how about this? Okay, so what we're talking about, Dr. Doerr, is that the human's ability to normalize the experience of loss helps one get through the day. This morning, I had trouble getting on the internet. I had loss of my intention was thwarted by technology. I had a loss of power in that moment. Okay, I can work with this.
Yeah.
How does one do that? Breathing more deeply and slowly, letting the mind say what it's saying and realize that loss is just an experience that as humans we deal with.
Yes.
And just to your point, our culture somehow has convinced us that we feel grief pretty much focused upon loss of the human being, the human body, death of a human. The truth is, to understand how to live well, have to recognize its loss of anything that we're attached to. My dog, the weather, the night, the day, whatever it is. It's about attachment and learning to breathe into that experience of loss.
Right. So that's, you know, that's another great thing that I think that you say, which is love is not the reason for grief. It's attachment.
It's attachment.
Right. So that's something that I think this is extremely insightful on your part, and something that I think is it's really, really meaningful and helpful.
It's the work I've been doing and the losses that I have had and lived through and learned to recognize that we change our relationship to what we've lost. What we've lost, that's just so.
Mm-hmm.
It's how we learn to relate to that which is out of our control. And the body can get anxious. The body can have a flood of hormones. What we want to do is learn how to live more comfortably in our skin. We could translate in this moment to self-care.
Mm-hmm.
Yet it's a practice. It's like yoga as a way of life. It's a continual practice of balancing. Yin yang and sun moon and left right. And so what we're really talking about here is how does one learn to take care of oneself in a world full of loss as a constant?
And then just remind us, how old was your husband when he transitioned and your sister when she transitioned?
My husband was 36 and he was a young man that had cancer at 23 the first time.
Okay.
My sister had breast cancer at 36 and then died at 49. Interestingly, okay. They both had 13 years of living with cancer as one of their teachers, cancer as their destiny. However, one might, in fact, find words to explain that type of journey.
Yeah. Obviously, a lot of people struggle with those, I tend to prefer to call them transitions. And again, as we talked before, to me, I see life as an ongoing, what I call catch and release, meaning that what I have now comes to me for whatever time it is, whether it's a person, whether it's a thing. And then it leaves. And so it's a matter of coming to me and then releasing it, letting it go. So that's what I mean when I say catch and release. And it's again, because we don't deal well with the idea that except the truth that everything is impermanent. Nothing is here forever in the form that it appears. The essence, the energy of it is, but the form that energy takes is temporary. It's finite. It's in terms of its time, it's limited. So because we don't really accept that truth, then And then we have these ideas, you know, again, that I think, you know, I think that we think that everybody, I don't know anybody that came here with a guaranteed expiration date. So, right. And again, to me, the idea that the soul comes here to do what it does, and then it's time for it to, then it goes. So I think, you know, when we have those unawareness of those, what we think and believe versus what's true and what's real, then we can create struggling and suffering for ourselves. So one, you know, we talked about that, but then also let's dig deeper into those, again, those non-death losses, and then we're going to come back to the ones where it's, you know, friends or loved ones or, right. So, you know, one of the things that I know to be true even for myself is that in terms of divorce, I realized it really wasn't the marriage that I was grieving. It was the fantasy of the marriage that I was grieving. Because if the marriage was all of that I idealized or fantasized, we wouldn't be getting divorced. So I think that, you know, that's significant in terms of identifying that. So we have, the marriages, job loss, you know, significant losses when it comes to money. What are some other ones that are considered non-death losses?
I have a list. I call it a loss awareness list.
Okay.
And I will indicate within the last 3 years, I've been adding different losses, such as during COVID, the inability to visit, hug, at times say hello, at times say goodbye.
Yeah.
Another loss that we experienced culturally, and I'm seeing this in my practice, is the impact of isolationism on the social creature. Whether it was a teenager who couldn't socialize between 13 and 16, or an older person who lost social contact around the age of 90, lost a will to live because of a lack of stimulation and meaningful human connection. So that's something that, as a culture, it's certainly in my experience, was a new period of time. Another type of loss.
You know what? If we could, before we go on beyond sure. that, because I think it's really, you know, again, let's kind of dig into that, meaning that sure. the loss of that social connection, how does that show up in the younglings versus how it shows up in the elders?
Okay.
In terms of the impact.
Okay. Great question. What I'm witnessing in the younger population is that social skills such as expressing oneself in a conversation, because teenagers are certainly seeking for their reflection in others, their individuation, their hormones are asking a lot of them, and they're attempting to fit into some social structure. So going to school every day and rubbing shoulders with friends in the hallway, having time at lunch, going out to the athletic field. These types of activities that I was fortunate enough to have, and you as well, I'm going to assume carefully, is that these kids didn't have that. What they did have was the computer and their phones. And so they learned to relate from a distance. So intimacy, yes, can be provided on a screen. We're working dearly together to include our audience in this type of deep conversation. Mm-hmm. Yet what we're talking about is now that they're in one another's physical presence, there's an awkwardness because there was a hiatus in their growth in their social aspect of just even being in class together. Now, this could be our topic for the whole time because of our concern to assist them in metaphorically catching up with themselves. So whether it's a 19-year-old or 14-year-old who didn't get to be in school between 11 and 14. So it's a developmental issue. It's a sociocultural issue. It's also an issue of developing natural confidence as a young person. I'm seeing a lot of that. The question comes up, says, Dr. Lynn, I'm not really sure who I am right now. Well, then we normalize. Adolescence asks that question. Now let's talk about your experience. Tell me more about that question. And we don't say why, we ask what or how or strategize, even dialoguing together or brainstorming together, how a conversation could sound with a touchy issue. So let me comment on the elders. For them, it was the social contact that was fueling them, that their friends were there. Because one of the greatest populations of humans that witness loss are elder people. Because as we're agreeing, we're here for a period of time. That's the magical mystery tour that the Beatles spoke about. And I use the phrase, I say, let's buckle our psychic seatbelts. This is going to be a wild ride. And so what we're saying here, Dr. Dorr, is the elderly population started talking more internally or watching TV a lot and finding a lack of sociocultural stimulation, even if it used to be sitting on a bench and talking for a half hour. So the human needs social contact. And now we're seeing how we're adjusting as a society and a global society to a new moment in our cultural history.
But you know what? I think though that whether it's the younglings or our elders, I think that it's still fundamentally the same core issue, which is identity, you know, because
yes.
In having the conversation with even some of the elders, it's okay. I've not been this age before, and they don't necessarily know other family members who have reached the age they have. So they don't know what it looks like. They don't know what to expect. So again, it's that, okay, who am I? What do I do? How do I do this in this next chapter? So I still think fundamentally, again, whether you're the younglings or the elders, the core issues of identity and transition to, you know, what's next. And as you've already pointed out, the lack of social interactions, what people, I don't know that folks necessarily recognize, is the lack of the lack of social interactions. That means then you're not having certain brain cells that develop, that wire and connect with each other, that fire together, that
yes.
That you also then get nutrients and blood flow and other things that come from those social interactions and those connections. From, you know, I frankly give my patients hugs, the ones that want them, and they love my hugs, you know, because I'm all in, right? because I know that hugs are healing. So
yes.
That's helping to release chemicals, right, that affect the brain and that affect the body. And so the lack of social interaction then, of course, is affecting brain development, especially for the younglings, but then also brain, but so their brain health for them and then brain health for the elders. So I think that along with is a significant part of, again, the issues of identity and transition to the next chapter and how you do that. So what has your work been with people around the losses they've experienced during the pandemic? Because of course this is, it's not the height of the pandemic, but this is the third year of the pandemic. It's not gone. So what's your work been with people around whatever losses they feel they've experienced during the pandemic?
The first place that I focus with a client is on normalizing what they're telling me. So I ask them to please tell me what's going on. What are you feeling? What are you thinking? What story can you share with me so that I can tune in and be with you? When we take a look at the story, then the work is called normalizing. So if a statement is, you know, I feel awkward now going back to school, then I normalize that and say, yes, this is an issue that many are having because of the lack of contact over this period. Because my work meets each individual exactly where they are. And I use active listening, repeating what it is they tell me to make sure that I'm fully presently aware of what they are saying. Because sometimes people talk around it, or that I hear one thing and the meta communication that I hear between the words might be telling me something else.
Okay, so for those who may not be aware, what's meta communication?
A meta communication, you see, we use our intuition, and we spoke of this last time. A meta communication is what we hear and sense between the words. The words can say one thing, and yet we're also hearing more or slightly other. That's when we humbly ask, I wonder if I'm understanding you fully, if I can understand correctly.
Yes.
And so in the repetition, the individual gets to hear themselves and say, oh, wait a minute, fine tune this word. So we're all hearing meta communications because we're also sensing with our whole self. So we might hear, put that away, and we might feel, oops, I should have put that away before. So we need to hear that the body has the voice. And when it says, oops, we might want to listen.
Okay.
Meta communication is just a way to hear between the words.
Okay. All right. So in you listening to what they're saying, and then also the meta communication of what's going on between the words, then what happens in the work you're doing?
I use skillful questioning. I believe, and what I've witnessed, is that the answers often reside right in the question. And if we approach the concept of wonderment and wanting to understand or wanting to know, and using all our sensory devices, body, mind, and our spirit, then we approach what we need to know and ask ourselves, what is it that I'm feeling? What am I sensing? What's going on? What's my body want me? So we use questions to explore. Oftentimes that helps an individual. A question that's not a yes or no, such as, can you please tell me more about the home you grew up in? And it invites communication. And if they're not ready, I always say, if you're not ready to respond to that, you're in charge here. You just tell me. We can revisit, or let's go elsewhere. Guide me here. Because it's an experience that we're sharing, the intention to seek clarity and well-being.
Okay. Now, is that an approach that a person could use with themselves?
Great question again. Yes. When we actually take a moment and say, it's called inquiry. We're inquiring. We're respecting ourselves enough to ask, what am I really feeling? And you see me do this. By now it's habit in my work. Left hand, right hand on the heart. A little tool here for everybody who's interested. All of us, I hope. This is compassion to self. This is what we do when we're honoring. This is a fabulous form of self-care. It goes right along with what Dr. Dorr mentioned about the healing value of hugs. This is a little self-hug. This is saying, I also do this in doorways when I visit somebody in the hospital. I stand at the doorway. I take a moment. I then encounter, engage, and approach. When I feel centered and grounded, this reminds me to do that. Nostril breathe, exhale longer, asking for me to be present in the moment. So the skillful questions might be, this has come up before. I would like to understand, what is this that I'm feeling? And then we let it go because we've already asked. We've already stated an intention to know. And so my work doesn't encourage pushing and forcing. It's allowing,
Okay.
breathing and allowing.
Now, here's the wonderful thing about your suggestion to put both hands, on our heart is scientists have discovered that we actually have cells in the heart that are similar to the ones in the brain. So it's that the heart knows. Not only the heart, quote unquote, feels as people, but the heart knows. And so by, placing our hands on our heart, what we're doing is then coming from the, I think what I call the fullness of the allness that the heart is, not only the feeling and the compassion, but also the knowing that the heart brings to get, I think, more insightful and deeper, more profound answers and ways of being with ourselves and with others and with each other.
I would love to add something to that, because you've just you've really opened this our moment for it. If we take the word heart, and we look at the letters that make up the word, there's an H-E-A-R. There's an ear in the heart. There's H-E-A-R, which is what you're saying, so the heart can hear.
Yes.
And so if we use our hearts and we acknowledge our hearts as a sensory tool, as well as the pump for our circulatory system.
Corazón.
Then, aha, corazón.
Corazón.
We honor it. And, I have an article that I'm writing, and there's a picture of a heart and there's a picture of an ear in it, because this is just such a delicious part of us. And it's about self-care. You mentioned hugs boost the immune system. Hugs give us a joy, human to human. I, too, love to hug my clients. And I can tell you that was a loss for me during COVID. I have learned to respect technology, and I praise Zoom because it's really efficient for us. I missed hugging clients.
Yes.
I missed humans in my office. I missed because I'm also a body worker. So my treatments personally combine body work with aromatherapy, Tibetan bowls, tuning forks, music that brings us into the parasympathetic nervous system. And for me as a practitioner, that was what I would call a loss during COVID, was the actual lack of human contact. So look how it shows up in different ways.
Right. So to go back to the other question I was asking, so that's one of the ways that even when a person is with themselves, I don't say alone, when you are with yourself, then those are a way that you can connect with your inner self to ask those questions and discover the answers to your thinking and feeling around transitions and losses. So and it sounded like also that your work, whether with younglings or with elders or anyone along the continuum, is similar. It's that they're guiding you.
Yes.
And of course you're asking questions and to discover, but also allowing them to go at the pace that they go. So we talked about again to get into that, those non-death losses, is COVID, and then what's some others?
Well, I'm going to refer to a book that I trust and love that's guided me. And it was written by one of my teachers, who's Stephen Levine. And he wrote a very curious, wonderful book, as simple and gentle and profound and valuable. It's called Who Dies? That's the title. And chapter 5 in that book talks about role models or dreams, as you mentioned before, that it's not just the marriage, it's the loss of the dream of what marriage would be. And we need to acknowledge what our dreams are. So Stephen guides us in this way to recognize what are the role models or the deep examples that we've set up for ourselves. And are we able to recognize that perhaps we've lost a job, we've lost a home, we've lost our car, we've lost our direction in our career. We use the word loss very casually in our culture, yet it's very meaningful because it describes an experience. All of
right.
a sudden, we're without something.
Yes.
So
And
Stephen,
I'm sorry. It's just that when you said this, something else I thought of as a loss is that I see is that when a child is diagnosed with a mental illness, then there's the loss of that parent's hopes and dreams for that child that also occurs and that also has to be grieved.
Yes, yes, it's perfect. Any hope or dream that we could use the word harbor or hold dearly in our hearts, when we face reality and that is not part of the true story, we grieve the loss of the dream. And so you're so accurate there. That's the subtlety of exploring what I also call embodied losses, because sometimes we can't explain to ourselves, well, it was only a dream. Yet we've been dearly hoping, planning, fantasizing. And we take the little losses, Dr. Dorr, and we often don't acknowledge them. Yet the body is the vehicle, the barometer of our truth. And losses can, in fact, become embodied. And sometimes a fresh loss will re-stimulate all other, tiny they may be, but cumulative. And we ask ourselves, why am I in so much pain? It was just a fender bender. It was just a vase that broke. It was just a neighbor that moved. It's how we talk to ourselves times like that. Can we find a compassionate way to say, I'm confused right now. This is really painful. What's going on with me? And just intend to know.
Right. And then also, again, I think the recognition that every thought we have is connected to a feeling. And every thought has a chemical associated with it. Every feeling has a chemical associated with it. And so those chemicals or hormones that we then release as a consequence of our thoughts or feelings are then taking action upon the body. So there is a physiological reason why we feel in our bodies what we think and feel in our brains.
Accurate, accurate. I have a chart that's the physiology of grief, or let's say the physiology of loss, and then the presence of grief. And one of the major effects, because the endocrine system is responsible for all these wonderful hormones and not so wonderful hormones. And so what we're looking at here is when we encounter loss, it may not be a surprise, but loss often shocks us. And that's certainly true with long-term illness. We can know somebody's quite sick and not be surprised when they die, yet go into shock because all of a sudden they're not sharing air with us on the planet. So we normalize that. And that's a very interesting one in the elder population as we're kind of watching one another. And what you're saying is really true, that the body as the vehicle of our truth, the barometer, is often affected by all the different hormones that go with the feelings and go with the thoughts. And one of the things I hear with loss is I'm numb. Well, we also have to acknowledge that numbness is a feeling. And sometimes it's a great gift, which gives us a chance to somehow begin to tune into this sudden change in our lives.
So, I'm sorry, I just wanted to ask you, because I was thinking about what you said earlier about allowing people to go at their own pace.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things, and I don't remember but many of the wisdom traditions will actually say, allow yourself a certain amount of time to grieve. And I think the intention of that is to so that people don't fall into chronic grief. And so one of the things I wonder about is, and you're allowing people to go at their own pace, is, but how do you help them avoid? Because I know some people have been stuck in grief for decades. Help them grieve mm-hmm. what would be a healthy period of time versus, a period of time that that is unhealthy, and that I see people kind of in some ways disconnect from other family members that are still here. They're not fully present for them. They're not very interactive. They're not living life fully in whatever way that looks like for them, because they're caught in their grief. So, I wonder about that.
Well, I often work, we have so many different theoretical possibilities of fabulous practitioners and teachers' work. And mine is a potpourri, how I work with an individual. I have a very comprehensive intake form so that they tell me what they're experiencing physically, what they're experiencing emotionally. Mm-hmm. And I ask a question on my form. Why are you asking for this visit? And what has prompted? And so they're looking at, I worked with a woman who walked in 2 years after her spouse's death and said, I'm ready. And we worked for about 4 or 5 months, and she felt ready to then continue to engage in her life.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's a false sense of loyalty that somebody carries, that if their beloved can't be with them, they're not going to enjoy their lives. Now, the system that I gravitate to quite often, and it's so, so workable, there's a teacher that I truly love and respect, and his name is Dr. William Warden. And he has the four tasks of mourning with different points in each of the tasks, such as adjusting to the reality of the loss, dealing with the pain of grief. And within each of his points, there's lots of room. There's lots of different identifying markers of what normal grief would look like. And I like this because, unfortunately, another one of my beloved teachers, let me say fortunately, yet unfortunately, some of her work has been misinterpreted. Mm-hmm. And that's Elizabeth Kubler-Ross. So a client might walk in and say, I'm stuck in anger and I'm not grieving well. Elizabeth set that system of learning to live with one's own demise, the stages of grief, were for people confronting their own mortality. Dr. William Warden has given us also mediators of mourning, closeness of relationship, nature of relationship.
So to clarify, what you're saying is Elizabeth Kubler-Ross's work is around your own personal transition out of the body, but it's not about other loved ones or other people, their transition out of the body, if I heard you correctly.
You did hear me correctly. I want to be very clear here. The other night on a television program, they brought her up and used the five stages of grief incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
I sat there like, no, 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 no. Because I love Elizabeth and I respect her. And here's the really delicate truth. The five stages of grief, which somehow they've taken Elizabeth's career and made it all about that, and she has a wide-ranging collection of books, books, books. The five stages, yes, particularly for those facing their own mortality.
Okay.
So her work is brilliant. Those five stages need to be clarified again and again because it's just so simple. It's like tongue in cheek, the five stages. It doesn't respect the depth of her work.
Mm-hmm.
Dr. Warden has taken a very wide approach for dealing with loss. Although when he wrote his work, it was relating to loss of another human.
Okay.
And so when I work with it, what I always say is, Dr. Warden's right on here. We can use all his work. Let's apply it to any loss that you're experiencing. Whatever loss it is, it's loss of something familiar. It's loss of part of your identity, because that loss reflected you and parts of your life.
Okay. So again, to make the connections, there are, I think, as the individual, what you were saying before, one of the ways to consider whether you're feeling or experiencing any kind of loss, or like I said, I also like the word transition, what's the next chapter, you know, what's next, is to ask the question about what dreams do I have and how is the reality, I would say, not consistent with what that dream is. And then how am I feeling about that? Does that sound reasonable?
Yes.
Okay. And so then the other thing that I think then we also need to look at too is there is what the individual experiences, right? But then there's also the collective. Like we have a collective consciousness, like we have an individual consciousness. We have a collective consciousness, you know, a global consciousness. And then there's also, you know, something you talk about, which is global grief. So talk to us about that.
Okay. My heart and my mind just traveled all the way to Cape Town, South Africa.
Okay.
And I was honored and invited to present my work at the Nelson Mandela Center at the Holocaust Museum in Cape Town. And when I shared my work, I was very aware of the fact that the audience of about 150 people were made up of many segments of the South African society, and that one of the common losses that the entire South African culture was dealing with was the impact of apartheid on the entire system, body, mind, and spirit of each person, of the entire culture, and the reemergence into the world after Nelson Mandela declared, "We deserve peace." Where I'm going with this is that each culture has its own losses, and what we share is the common thread of all being human. And so when I work with an individual, I also ask about their heritage. My people, my grandfather, I realized when I started crying when the Ukraine war began, was actually not born in Russia per se, was born in Ukraine. And so my loss and my tears, not even yet able to identify, why am I crying so deeply right now? Is the fact that my genetic bloodline is still there in Ukraine. Global grief is real. We share loss. We share the loss of elephants and rhinos, extinction. I go to South Africa to be with the animals, and I love the people, and I love the food. Anybody who loves food, you don't want to miss South Africa. What I'm saying is, globally, we have a malaise. There's a name for it, Dr. Dorr. The name is called solastalgia. It's made up of two words, nostalgia and solitude. And it's the same, we don't have to leave our houses to be grieving the loss of the familiar. And a perfect example globally is if my neighbor sells his land to a fracking company, I wake up one morning and there's fracking right next door. So there's, we grieve for that which was, and it's a global malaise. So when people approach my work, we normalize. You have your personal loss. We're dealing with global grief. It exacerbates our personal pain. And for empaths, that's very deep work to understand how to recognize we feel so much, and how in order to take care of ourselves, we have to learn ways to discharge the holding of global pain.
So right. And so, and again, for somebody who might not be familiar, you know, fracking is a process of extracting natural gas, and, you know,
yeah, it could be
quite damaging to the environment. Yeah. So obviously it can be damaging to not just only the land where it's happening, but also neighbors and those in the community. So that's why it's having a community impact. So whether we're talking about grief for the individual or we're talking about global grief, again, because everything is made of energy, right?
Yes.
The energy that I hold within my body is going to impact my body, because that energy, especially, it's over time, it's going to become something in the physical. So whether that's something in the physical is a thought, something in the physical is a feeling, then becomes a chemical, which then of course is affecting blood flow, right? Because you can have and pressure, right? Blood pressure. And so then is the blood getting to the various organs, brain, heart, kidneys, livers, all of those things. So that energy over time is going to become something physical. And if that something is negative, then it has a harmful impact on the body and the brain, which then can become illness. So these are the reasons why we don't want, we should take time to grieve. It's the reason why we don't want to hold on to grief, right? Why we need to hold on to those feelings. Yes. And we need to grieve whatever it is, the loss of the transition, and then release that energy.
Yes. And I'd like to return to responding to your prior question about timing. Mm-hmm. Each person has their own relationship to loss. There we have the dichotomy of human existence, because we're all the same and we're all different. So tuning into another to recognize what it is they're looking at, dealing with, feeling at a time of loss also involves understanding what else they might be carrying that they never felt safe enough to express. Mm-hmm. And Kubler-Ross taught me, Elizabeth told me, Lynn, we either express or we repress. And so our bodies are miracles, and we can hold on to a lot of past information. And what you're talking about is when there's an accumulation, how do we begin to release the holding that we're asking of the body? That's the delicate dance of meeting each person where they are. Some might like to go. I have one woman loves the isolation tank. She just feels relieved, released, and thrilled to be there. Somebody else goes to dance. Another goes to a church and prays and sings and chants. And by the way, that kind of activity for this part of the body, good for the vagus nerve, singing, chanting, expressing. What we're really saying is each person has their own relationship. We don't get over our losses. We change relationship to them.
Yes. And so, you know what, you mentioned some of the therapies that you work with. And if you could, and describe briefly what those look like, how they work. And then also, we're going to get into what are some things that individuals can do to help themselves grieve.
Okay. I'd like to say to our audience that anybody who emails me and would like some documentation on what I call, for example, somatic quick tips, running one's hand under cold water and shaking them out, because anatomically, the hands are an extension of our heart. So these hands are precious and full of the nerve endings. If we look at reflexology, nerve endings in all are in our feet and our hands. Each person, especially starts with the intake form, tells me, do they like dance? Do they like swimming? Do they like hot tubs, cold soaks? Do they like walking on the beach, playing tennis, doing yoga? All of these integrative therapies use body and mind in order to perform the action thereof. So an integration, a brain balancing, a yin-yang, our nervous system starts to equilibrate when we ask the body to participate. So it could be painting, collage, aromatherapy. How do I, with the client, create what we call a self-care plan? What can they do that makes them feel more able to stay comfortably in their own body? What's the mind-body connection? Is it 20 minutes of writing when they wake up, or doing an exercise, an ancient yogic practice called Tratak, which is focusing tool, balancing the pineal gland and the breath and the optic nerves? I suspect that EMDR is from this ancient 5,000-6,000-year-old tool from the yogic tradition. So your question is that each person, I'm the guide helping them find what works for them to feel grounded and centered and acknowledge the truth of what they're feeling.
Okay. And then you mentioned EMDR, which is for our audience.
For our audience. It's rapid desensitization using motion and optic nerve. And it is shown to release traumatic holdings, because trauma turns our whole system inside out and upside down. And sometimes we have post-traumatic stress from traumatic events, very understood. We're understanding more and more all the time. EMDR is a specific approach to release the held memories that create anxiety, pain, and suffering for an individual. This tool,
and frankly, the feelings of threat.
Please.
You know, I think that's the other thing too. Please. Just again, as a reminder, one of the reasons people loss is so problematic is because the loss of whomever or whatever can create a sense of threat, right? You know, what happens to me now?
Yes, I'd love to differentiate the terms trauma and grief in terms of the impact of loss.
Right, but even in the sense of I'm just going to say a parent or a spouse. We kind of talked about this before. There can still be the sense of what happens to me now, because if that person was responsible for me in some way, whether it be, again, whether it's basic and fundamental, such as finances, or if it's more, this person provided a great deal of counsel, support, and nurturing.
You're so right. And
right.
You just described Dr. William Warden's mediators of mourning. So let's use your example. If a child loses a parent and they are financially dependent on that to continue to go to school, to be able to have the needs met, if it's a financially dependent relationship, it might have a different, it certainly would have a different grieving process than an independent child, that the loss is huge, yet it doesn't threaten the quality of life or the actual ability to keep maintaining a familiar lifestyle. So you're totally correct. And that's the key to really meeting a person where they're at, because there's things sometimes they're not used to telling us, and we need to encourage that.
So, you know, I want to, of course, thank you for the work you do, and thank you for, you know, having this conversation with me, and providing such invaluable, you know, insights and information and, you know, ways of healing one's grief around losses and transitions. And you mentioned that there was some of the resources that you have. So again, how do people, you know, connect with you? I know you've got some workshops that you're doing that are coming up. So how do we engage with you?
How do you find me?
Okay. Yeah.
I want to tell my audience that one of the things that I truly love to offer is the Day of the Dead training. During the actual celebrations in Mexico, I'm going to offer this November 30th to October 30th to November 3rd. coming up, 2023, in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico. We're just going to learn from the Mexican culture and immerse ourselves in a new perspective. And we'll use expressive arts, lots of aromatherapy, lots of movement, lots of deep didactic conversation transformed into the pragmatic usage. I am available online on degriefing.com. And I want to say that degriefing is, in fact, an oxymoron, because as we are here together, honoring the work that we both do, the doctor and I, there is loss happening all around the world. Degriefing is the intended use of grief as fuel for transformation. I can be reached by phone. I can be reached by contact form on my website. I'm very available.
And what's your website again? What's your website?
Degriefing.com, G-R-I-E-F-I-N-G.com. I welcome you getting in touch. I've also already heard from some people who heard segment number one, asking some questions and wanting more information. So my heart is saying that we're reaching people who are ready to take a look.
Awesome.
And normalize their relationship with their life.
Awesome. So, awesome.
Yes. And thank you, because this vehicle is your creation, this sweet spot, this moment together. What a delicious way to honor the truth that we're all impermanent. What are we going to do while we're here?
Yes.
How are we going to take care of this vehicle?
How am I going to demonstrate or have the greatest expression of my infinite potential of living life in a sweet spot, right? And I want you to know that our conversation actually helped somebody too the night that it aired. There was someone that I happened to meet, and I had actually had it playing on my phone because I was out, and she heard a portion of it. And the conversation that I had with her around the murder of her child was helpful to her, and she shared her appreciation. So I wanted you to know that as well. Those you know about, but there are some that you don't know about. And anything else that you have coming up in terms of any workshops or other?
Yes.
Other things?
I'm going to be presenting for the California Institute of Integral Studies in April.
Okay.
I'm presenting for the Santa Clara Behavioral Sciences, Santa Clara, California, in May. On my website is a list of offerings. I offer specific seminars for sibling loss, for spousal loss, for child loss, and I'm offering a mentoring group for professionals that would like to deepen their ability to hold space for loss. And I work with addiction specialists who are dealing with loss all the time so that they learn to take care of themselves. And that's really important. And I want to say that to thank you for this opportunity. And those of us in service, Jack Kornfield from Spirit Rock says, compassion without self-compassion is not as impactful.
Yes.
So it's asking us to walk our talk.
Yeah.
And practice self-care,
right,
to honor those that whom we've lost, but those whom we serve, so that we are on our professional edge. And we ask you to take a look at your self-care and recognize that we deserve our self-care.
Right.
Deserve to learn to love ourselves.
Yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, so with that, I want the audience to obviously treat yourself with kindness. Some people find love, treating themselves with love, more challenging, but treat yourself with kindness, understanding that kindness also includes being in harmony and flow with life. What the truth of things, the fact that nothing is permanent, the fact that what you think and hold in your beliefs becomes energy and chemicals that affect your body. So it is important that we make the best of whatever it is we have with us in the moment, because nothing has a guaranteed expiration date, except this. I don't even know if the stuff that has it on the boxes, right? I don't even know if those expiration dates are accurate. So understanding that nothing is permanent, there's no guaranteed expiration date, that we make the best and the most of who we are, who is with us, have the greatest demonstration of our infinite potential, and then flow into and move forward into that which is waiting for you. And
namaste, amen.
Yes, namaste. Thank you so much to my guest. And I am Dr. Balin A. Durr, awakening and empowering you to live out your infinite potential, to live life in the sweet spot. Make sure you like, follow. Be sure to like, follow, and share our conversations. And see you next time. Thank you for joining us today in the sweet spot. Share, follow, and like us on social media. To learn more, please visit BalinADurrMD.com, spelled BalinADurrMD.com. Join us next week, and remember, when you heal your mind, all things are possible.